Dr. Yvette Simmons-Reed, and she will be talking about how these bills are being impacted by disabled citizens. She spoke on it briefly, and how that goes into and impacts the critical race theory. So, Dr. Reed, the floor is yours.
Thank you, Lee. Thank you very much. I really appreciate all of you being here, our speakers and folks from around, across Indiana and around the country. You know, we hear a lot on TV about critical race theory and all this other stuff. And, you know, people wonder, you know, what's true, what's not true. I want to first just kind of put some, clarify or make some connections. I'm one who speak pretty direct, and so I don't want you to miss it while you're here. The reason why we had Sarah on and John and Jeff today, you may think, well, what does the school bill in Indiana have to do with voting, and why would you put those two together? Well, we know, as Sarah mentioned, it's our school boards, okay, that makes decisions, typically, okay, for our school districts. And our school board members are elected. So we must have the right to vote in order to elect those people who represent our interests. And given that this is Diversity, Equity, Inclusion Committee, we want to make sure that the interests of a diverse population, which is what this country was built on, have appropriate and proper representation in from our local, state, and national level. So voting is important. And I think, you know, we become complacent sometimes and think the only election matters is the national election. Well, what's going on right now across this country is evidence of why it is so critical that we pay attention to all elections. And so I just wanted to make that statement real quickly. I want to do a quick little activity before we get started, because I know the topic that I'm talking about tonight is can be very divisive or raise concerns by folks. And that's not our purpose here. We want to have a dialogue. My goal is always to not tell you what to think, but give you some things to think about as we go along here. So there's no indoctrination going on. We just want to educate and give you some things to think about. So the first thing I want to start with is let's think about what we value. What do we value? Earlier today, I had an opportunity to participate in our Provost Summit. And in this Provost Summit, there's colleges across the state of Indiana. It's sponsored by LEAP Indiana. And they bring together higher ed faculty across the state to, you know, talk about things that impact higher education. And due to the pandemic, one of the things that we've been, you know, really focused on is student bandwidth, cognitive capacity. In 2020, many of our students, the schools were shut down. You know, whichever side of the you're on in terms of the school shutting down, they shut down, and so students did not have access to education. Many of our students, did not have online, virtual internet and all that stuff. So many schools went out of their way to try to make that happen. We still today have a significant number of students not in schools because of the pandemic, because of health issues, and all that stuff. So, there's some things that are going on. But getting back to my point in terms of what we value and bandwidth, we know that bandwidth or the capacity to think about other things impacts learning. Okay. So if you are poor, if you are hungry, if you have daycare issues, now come on, you guys. Some of you are dealing with this, trying to teach your kids and do your job at the same time, you know, at home, because of the daycare issues, daycare shortages, or school being shut down. Some of you, you know, are struggling with taking care of family members who are sick from COVID. Okay. And trying to work and trying to care for your children. So we all are struggling with this bandwidth issue, you know, in order to, you know, make it every day. So one of the things we talked about was, some of that is thinking about what we value, and I'm putting it in that context. So if some, and I'm putting it in that context because there's a lot of divisiveness, and a lot of folks using the fears of some, like Sarah mentioned, that there's a fear that, you know, kids are going to be indoctrinated, whatever that means, taught something that they shouldn't be taught. And there are others who know very well that's not happening, but they're utilizing that to continue this divisiveness. So tell me about some values. What do you value? You know, you can unmute. I need two or three people. Just tell me some things that you value and why you value them. And I'm thinking about family, religion, education, prosperity. Tell me some things you value.
What? Anyone can unmute if they need to, but this is Mike Lobb. I value independent living, and that might sound strange, but when you think of the cost, or, you know, for some people it's issues of discrimination or questions of their competency come into play. But I mean, I don't take that for granted. I think about that. Be able to live where I want, but have to make compromises because, you know, I need to be able to have groceries delivered, or, you know, there's things you have to make choice about, especially if you want to live more rural as opposed to being in a larger urban metropolitan area.
So you value being able to take care of yourself and live independently.
Yes.
Okay. Anybody else?
Ron Brown. Yes, I value family. I value financial independence. I also value my work and what it means to me to be able to go to work every day.
Why is that? Why do you value those things?
I value those things because, number one, family is important to me because, if you have a support when all else, well, and I'll just put it in context of myself, when all things have failed around me, my family was always there to support me, pick me up by my bootstraps, tell me it was going to be all right, and continue to move forward. And so I really value that support system around me, which is family. I value financial independence simply because I know that we live in a capitalistic society and money means independence. And having that helps me, especially as a blind man, to get security within my life and into my family. I value my work ethics because, number one, a lot of my self-esteem and my self-worth is tied up into my work. And so, therefore, feeling good about myself gives me an opportunity to get out and participate in the world and be a contributing factor in this society instead of feeling like I'm just a blemish on society, or I have to be taken care of. So that financial independence and my self-worth is tied up into my work ethics.
And thank you for that. That was excellent. So valuing your family, because that's your backbone. That's your, that those are the people that you know that support you. You have that circle of support no matter what you do, you know, that unconditional love. Right. And then I heard you say that you value your financial, you know, prosperity or wealth, in order to not only, because we live in this kind of society and things cost and you want to live the way you want to live, but also to take care of that family that you care about, you know, making sure they have what they need. And correct me if I'm wrong, Ron. And then you said that you also value your work ethic, because that's what provides you, that's part of your identity. Okay. That's what gives you your self-worth.
Yes.
Was I summarizing that right?
Yes, ma'am.
So we live in this country, and you know, I you made me think about when we introduce ourselves, quite often we say our name and we say what we do. That's part of the values of our country. I think we had two other people, then I'm going to go on. Tyler and then Diane. Is Tyler?
I think Tyler left, but Diane lowered her hand, but you could speak if you like, Diane, but Lee raised his hand. So.
Go ahead, Lee, and then Diane.
Okay. If Diane's okay. One thing I value more than a lot of things is security and our freedoms in this country and those that protect our freedoms in this country. The freedoms that we have, whether it's for our families, our freedom of speech, even with the H.R. 1134, you know, the freedoms that we have in this country that are protected by those that are in the armed services oftentimes go overlooked, because without those those individuals protecting our country, none of this that we're talking about today would not be possible. So that's one thing that I've learned to value as we go through our daily chores and our daily lives, is the freedom to stay from not being censored, the freedom that we have as just American citizens to go about freely to live some of the values that we just heard about. So that's what I really value is when you look at sometime when I personally look at it and being in the armed services and being on the front lines there and being able to serve our country and our members of our citizens of our country with your life on the line, while people take that oftentimes on a daily basis, don't even think about it. But those are some of the securities that I believe in and that I value, not just for myself, but for my family, for my fellow man here in the United States of America.
And thank you, Lee. So valuing your freedom and the ability to be able to have these kind of conversations, right? You talk about censorship and being able to speak up, or, you know, and that is definitely things that are defended by our military. And we thank you for your service and important. I think we got Diane, then Marilyn, and then we're going to move on.
Marilyn's raised her hand.
Okay, go ahead, Marilyn.
All right. I value my faith and the ability to worship freely. Mm-hmm. I value history, and I value advocacy in two ways. I value the ability to advocate for our civil rights and as individuals living with blindness and other disabilities. So my faith, our history, and advocacy in civil rights and disability issues.
Tell me why you value history.
If you do not know and respect history, the pros and cons, it is bound to repeat itself. And history teaches us where we are, where we have been, and where we are bound to go.
Thank you so much. Thank you. So when we think about these things, from what we heard just now, I would bet, not a betting person, but I would bet that everything that was just spoke about, every one of us on this call value. Okay. So the divisiveness that's meant to tear us apart, we need to keep our eye on the prize, because something that Lee said, you know, these values that we have are fragile in this pretty young democracy, in terms of the not only the values, the freedoms that we have are pretty fragile in this young democracy of ours. So it is critical that we think and keep our minds on, you know, not our differences, but where are we similar? And those are those things we talk about. So I come to you today to talk about critical race theory, what it is and what it is not, because that is what sparked a lot of the vitriol and legislation and some of the disinformation and miscommunications that's been going on. And so first and foremost, Any of you, when we talk about inequities and racial inequities in particular, would you all agree with me that there are racial inequities in our living situation? You know, where we live, you know, that people of color are less likely to own their own homes than white Americans. Would you agree with me that people of color have a mortality rate for maternal and infants and maternal mortality rate for women and children are higher for those people of color than it is white women and children? Would you also agree with me that the access to education and high quality education, there is a disparity between people of color and whites in this country? If you disagree with me on any of those, please raise your hand. Go ahead, Diane. If you are talking, we cannot hear you. Diane, okay. Okay, I'm sorry. My video is acting up. Give me 1 second. Can everybody still hear me? Lee, can you hear me?
Yes. I still hear you. You're good.
Okay. All right. I'm sorry. Okay. So so when we talk about critical race theory, that's simply the major emphasis of critical race theory. It's a framework that talks about or looks at, gives an analysis of the inequities and how those inequities are perpetuated in our society. It started in the 1960s. I'm sure there's been conversations, but it gained momentum in the 60s, 70s, and 80s in terms of looking at how our social and economic institutions have the laws, procedure, and practices that that are embedded in racism, and those who in the those who are on the margins of society are continue to be impacted, you know, negatively. So I'm sure some of you've heard that term, pull yourself up by your bootstraps, you know. The comeback for that is, if I don't have boots, that's going to be kind of hard. The assumption that we all start in the same place, for example, all of us on this call, okay? All of us on this call may have blindness in common, but I would say to you that none of us, or most of us, you know, have started in different places. Some of us have more privileges than others, okay? So critical race theory is a framework for looking at the inequities and overcoming some of those inequities and those power dynamics to stop the status quo, you know, to change what's going on. I'm sorry, my phone is going nuts here. I'm sorry, give me 1 second. There are specific tenets of critical race theory that I want to talk about. So again, I said critical race theory provides a framework for looking at the persistence of these racial inequities that we all know exist. So the first tenet of critical race theory is race is a social construct, and the way that it is defined and experienced is a result of social and political thought and actions. Now, we talk about race and disability as if they really exist. I will tell you that both of those things are social constructs created by those in power, okay? Because, again, we are more similar than we are different. We may have shades, you know, of color, okay? But we are more similar than we are different. And when we talk about disability, from a social justice perspective, we are only as disabled as the context we're put in. So if I ask a room full of my colleagues, And for those who wear glasses or contacts, to take those things away, okay? Some of them would have just as much issues as those who are blind, okay? Because they are being put into context, or we turn the light off. This is something that my sons, I have two boys, that are always teasing me. It's like, Mom, why do you have the light off? I don't need it. Although I got to pay the bill, I don't need it. So, you know, I have a skill in walking around in the dark, but, you know, a lot of sighted folks, the first thing they do is turn the light on. Okay. So there are some recognizing the diverse range of, the whole range of human diversity is important. So to put that in, just wanting to put that in context, that we create these differences for a reason. Race is the way to categorize, classify, and it's the same thing for disability. And it's the way they measure, you know, different things in different ways across our society. So we know in special ed, we have the different disability labels, and we make a big deal about those disability labels. And we, you know, different disability labels garner the districts a certain amount of money. Okay. And we know that people who have the power, I've been in education for, more than 30 years and, taught every level and almost every disability category. And I will share with you that parents with power and influence, have the ability to, have their child put in categories where there's a lot more funding and a lot more opportunity. And I'll say right now that's in the area of autism and formerly learning disability. But when you look at categories like severe emotional disturbance, that category has an overrepresentation of kids of color. So another inequity that we talk about that critical race theory helps us understand. Give me one second. I'm sorry, my computer jumped. CRT also tries to avoid this conflation of race and racist. One of the disinformation that I hear all the time when you turn the TV on and you've heard it at the school boards is that CRT is teaching the kids, you know, to hate white people. And that was definitely in this bill, 1134. It does just the opposite. As I said, the focus is on institutional processes, procedures that perpetuate inequities. It says nothing about racist point out any particular group for being racist. It talks about the institutional practices that, as a result of behavior or attitudes and bias, result in the inequities that we talk about. Tenet 3, because the differential treatment of individuals based on racial classification is embedded in our social systems and institutions, including public policies and law, racism is commonplace rather than rare. And we can say it just like ableism, racism, and all the other isms is as common as apple pie. Okay. Because they're embedded in the system. And we try to normalize that. We expect those who are not in the positions of power to navigate that. But it is challenging. And I think that's, again, why we're all here, because of the institutional policies and practices that are fundamentally racist. Okay. That continues to impact, you know, whether that keeps one group above another group. Let me say that. So it's systematic practices that ensure that certain groups, typically white males, are more likely to achieve those goals based on their values than another group. Those were three tenets. The fourth tenet of CRT, while racism is perpetuated in our structural and systems at the, say, macro level of society, listening to and understanding the lived experience of people, is essential for understanding how racism works to create inequities. So I just gave you four tenets of CRT, and we can look at those tenets across multiple areas, whether it's policing in this country, okay, who is police most? And they said, well, they're the ones, you know, shooting each other. Well, ask yourself the question, why? Where are these shootings happening? Are they happening in what we term ghettos or the projects, where the living conditions create situations where people are desperate to get food? You know, are they in those areas where there's scarce resources? Are they in the areas where there's a lot of resources? Okay. So asking yourself why those things are different. That's what CRT, it is a framework. This idea, and let me just say this, another misconception is that, oh, we were teaching this in our K-12 schools. I got 3 degrees, all of them from The Ohio State University. One of the largest, maybe second largest now, it goes back and forth, universities in the country. And not one course did I take, or remember conversation, even in some of my multicultural classrooms, was CRT ever taught? It comes from legal studies, and it was a way to start examining some of these issues that have been perpetuated over time, and begin to act on some of those issues. And, those are some of the challenges, that we face. And so when we talk about, I think Jeff is the one mentioned about theory. In theory, there's a lot of things possible, right? But is it true? You know, and we know that, we know that just because something's a theory does not, or can possibly happen, doesn't mean it's happening. And that's the kind of thing that our educators are dealing with right now. Our children are dealing with right now. We have a high degree of concern because without having the ability to examine and look at these things, in a systematic way, which is what, critical race theory allows us to do, then we will continue the status quo. And some folks may be comfortable with the status quo, but I give to you, there are more people who are not. And that's what this scramble to change and pass these laws right now, are about. I'm going to stop there and take questions. There's a lot more to be said. I'm providing resources, critical race theory. I'm sorry. Before I stop, I want to talk about disability critical race theory. Over the last like it's 2013. In the last 10 years, let's say that, there has been, a move to look at, use critical race theory to look at the, impact, on, individuals with disabilities. And, disability critical race theory is one of those new, theoretical frameworks that, looks at how race and disability are, work together in interlocking, systems of oppression. This is something that's long been the case. Again, it's a way of analyzing how, society, the systems, and I will give you special ed as well. Systems of oppression, or policies and practices work, to perpetuate, the outcomes that we see. And so, you know, we wonder, you know, why are we putting all this money into these systems and it seems like nothing's ever changing? Because It's the systems, it's the institutional policies that create, perpetuate the inequities that we see. And the reason that we need to focus on those inequities in order to make change. Any questions?
Dr. Reed, I have a question. This is Lee. Uh-huh. And one of my questions, with the, what is and what isn't, when you hear about shaming. I'm often hearing about, you know, one race being shamed, and with the education of our students in the schools, and also now, you know, even in the libraries, you got groups around the in the country taking challenging the libraries about some of the literature that they have or books that they have in the libraries, and they demanding that these books and stuff be taken out because of shaming. Could you explain to me and others exactly what shaming is? I know we're over our time, but if you could quickly explain and take a few other questions, I'd appreciate it.
Sure. Again, this is, and I don't have time to talk about this, but I've talked about it in the past. We talk about racial identity development, and there's a difference between the racial identity development for Blacks and or African-Americans and that of whites. And so, some of this shaming, and we all go through this, these processes. And so we talk about shaming. It's not somebody shaming you. Okay. Part of the process of racial identity development for, and I'll talk about white specifically, is going through that process. They hear something, you know, and, you know, they may be familiar with, you know, their culture, which makes sense. But then when they get into a situation where, you know, in an unfamiliar situation, maybe, and this often happens so when you go into, most of the time this happens when white children go off to college. I one of my best friends said to me the first time she ever met a Black person was in college, ended up being her roommate. And they got along great, but how fearful she was from all that she heard on TV and all these other things. So when they're referring to shaming, they got a little bit upside down. It's not that someone is trying to shame them. It's that when they learn of some of the atrocities that happen, we talk about slavery, when we talk about the experiences. And the first thing that came to my mind was the book by Toni Morrison, Beloved. It has nothing to do with, it was the story of a woman and her experience. Nowhere in the book does it try to shame anyone. It is a book about a woman and her experience. And, but they've made that into, you know, they're trying to shame us. Honestly, what we're trying, the whole goal of teaching these things in our schools is to teach empathy, to understand, as Marilyn pointed out, you know, history's important. So we know where we've been in order to get where we're going. And so they've got it a little backwards, because it's not someone shaming them. When something happens, or someone in my family does something, right? Or in my ancestors, you know, you should feel a little bit of shame. And if you're going to feel a little bit of shame, then you're going to go make sure that doesn't happen in the future, or as much as possible. So there's no shaming going on, but through our social emotional learning, we want to teach children empathy, how to get along, perspective taking, et cetera. So does that answer your question, Lee?
Yes, ma'am. It answers it. And I know I need to study more on it like everyone else. You know, I think that the session here, as we have gone over.
Oh,
so there's somebody else with a question.
Dr. Peters.
Go ahead, Dr. Peters. Ray. Dr. Peters, thank you.
Okay, thank you. I really didn't have a question, but Dr. Evie, I just wanted to thank you so much for sharing. You have great expertise, and we really respect that. So thank you very much.
Thank you, Ray.
All right. Yeah, definitely. Thank you for sharing, and thank the committee for bringing this to our attention. I just really just wanted to touch on shaming, and just wanted to just give my experiences with, you know, shaming. And since critical race theory became real big topic across the country. And I'm just really growing up, you know, I grew up, you know, moved from Gary and moved, and then I moved to Maryville, which was diverse and had a lot of different ethnicities. At the time, probably more Caucasians at the time. But when you talk about, you know, when they talk about, you know, slavery, and then they brought up, you know, history as a young black male at the time, and not, you know, even me and another couple other, you know, young black male, you know, in the class, you know, our history was, you know, shrunken down to like a paragraph and a black man and some chains, you know. So to me, that felt, you know, kind of awkward. You know, I was kind of ashamed because, you know, I didn't know as much as I know now, but I know my history started before 1619. So, mm-hmm. you know, if you're not teaching it properly, you're going to be ashamed, you know, because of the thing that the imagery is definitely the imagery that stuck with you. So now, you know, we're dealing, you know, with prejudice, you know, that I'm dealing with as a young child, you know, not even knowing because it's covert at the time. So, but those type of things, yes. But I believe that if you're teaching it, you have to have someone that's going to be able to teach it correctly. I believe that, you know, it has to be its own special class in a sense, because some people are not going to teach history, you know, how history needs to be told. So. That's just mm-hmm.
No, I love that because you raise a really important point that we need to remember is and that our children know, understanding their history, seeing themselves in books and seeing themselves reflected in positive ways, as well as understanding there were struggles. And to me, to know that when this pandemic hit, I was able to go back and start reading about 1918. And oh my gosh, that was like, okay, we can make it. Our ancestors been through this, and this is what they did. And this is how they, you know, so that matters. It matters to all, not only our white children, it matters to our kids of color as well. And I think we can take one more, Lee.
Ron Brown.
Go ahead. We have
William with a hand up.
All right. Thank you, Dr. Reed. I appreciate, the topic and, probably in the future, can we, I really want to focus on what you talked about at the end of your presentation, and that's disability and critical race theory. The reason why I want to talk about that, because I think it's such an impactful development that you brought up, and it affects all of us on this call based on our blindness. And so my question to you, and you may not have time to answer it, is when you talked about disability and critical race theory, are you talking about the way that even the blind and others with disabilities fit on the hierarchical chart of where we stand with in our own disability and in the disability rights movement? And are you talking about things such as voc rehab and the way they do service delivery based on our disabilities? Because I know that a lot of blind people and people that serve of the blind feel that, you know, we're such a high impact disability that you know, it's hard to get closures for us. And so I'm wondering, when you mention that, is this about the institutions and the way they deliver services and things of that nature?
You've hit it right on the money. Absolutely. And we can talk about it all day, Ron.
I know. That's why I said absolutely. I don't want to. We definitely yes. got to hit that. We definitely. Yes.
So, that'll be the next chapter. Absolutely. Because it is those institutional practices. And you ask it, why are we such a high impact? Why is it so hard to get us, you know, people employed who are blind or visually impaired? You know.
Okay. And I think we had a William.
Yes.
A William. Okay. William.
Thank you. I want to say good evening to you all from Ohio. Dr. Reed, this is an excellent presentation. And you were talking about the racism, dealing with those of us who are black and blind and have low vision. As a black man here in Cleveland, I've known persons of color that have low vision. They seem to have, for lack of a better word, hopelessness. You know, I can't get a job. I'm black. I'm blind. I can't see. I won't try. And I think that that's probably the case all over the country. So, and I know me and Dr. Peters have talked about this. I think, what can we do in the Federation to address this? Because I know Ron was just talking about the hierarchy, and I do believe there is a hierarchy. We may not want to talk about it out loud, but as quiet as kept, there is a hierarchy. And unfortunately, that keeps a lot of people of color down. So I think that that's something here in the Federation. consideration that we have to address as whites and people of color. And I'm not sure if you could answer, but how can we start to address this? Because this has a negative impact on this population. Excellent presentation.
Yeah, thank you so much. And William, thank you so much for your question. I would just begin by addressing that by saying it's called internalized racism. And so that is the byproduct of years and your live of internalizing to where you lose your self-worth. You feel like nothing matters, you know, that, you know, no one cares. You begin to operate in the way that you are perceived. I remember a professor telling me that when she was in school, very gifted individual, but so often, you know, she was coming against racism because she was very smart, didn't have to try hard to get stuff done. And after a while, she was always being accused of, you know, whatever they were accusing her of. So when she started acting out, doing the very things that they, you know, said that she was like, okay, you want to call me, you know, this, then I'm just going to be that way. And so sometimes there's no way out. I will say in terms of the Federation, what can we do? What we're doing right now, educating ourselves, educating the people in our networks, pushing back on the inequities, not just outside of the Federation, but within the Federation. You know what, you know, we've been having these conversations. We've started these DEI committees across the country. What we're doing right now is what we do, and make sure that our schools reflect and our books are reflecting that, our people, you know, and specifically our males, have lots of successes. But if our kids never open a book to see people who look like them, where are they going to get that from? So, I'd love to keep this conversation going, but I know there, I want to be respectful. We're already over time, and Lee's mentioned it a couple of times, but, let's keep this conversation going.
And in conclusion, I would like to say thank you all for taking the time and staying on with us. And as we have our DEI committee meetings across the country, many of our DEI meetings, we just have small numbers of people to attend. We have tried here within our state as well as across the country, other DEIs, but we know that this is kind of new to a lot of folks, or maybe some people may be rebellious against DEI and might not even understand why it exists. So it is incumbent upon us, as we have shared this evening, to take what you have shared and see how we can continue to grow it. And as Mr. John Perret indicated, you can call our national president, and if you want to see some action taken, we got our second vice president on the call here, Mr. Ron Brown, and I'm sure that he can relay some of this information as we continue to try to get the information out, because that's one thing that we're all about is diversity, equity, and inclusion, and we need to make sure that we secure that within our own organization. So once again, we just want to thank you from the DEI committee up here in Indiana, and look forward to next month when we come on. We may continue this conversation. So thank you once again. You guys have a safe evening, and we look forward to talking with you in the very near future.